altitude, and altitude. Those are the three things that make it work well. Very similar to real estate, location, location, location. If you have the ability to raise that antenna on VHF so it clears the trees, so that it is higher than the local trees. I recently found out people misunderstand when I say clear the trees. I think I mean cut them down. Uh-oh, that's not what I'm saying. If you're high enough to be clear of those trees, foliage attenuation becomes something that other people have and you don't have it. I've kept records in the past of guys on 432 whose antennas were higher than the trees and guys that were not. The guys with higher than the trees had much stronger signals, and they were strong summer, winter, spring, and fall. The guys whose antennas were below the trees were pretty good in the winter, kind of weak in the summer, and they faded out entirely on a rainy day when there's water on those leaves. So foliage attenuation on VHF is very significant. Also, on VHF frequencies, every time you raise the altitude of your antenna, so that the nearest blockage to you, that hill that's a mile away or whatever, dips away one more degree, everything over that hill is 6 dB louder. Rough rule of thumb for VHF-UHF propagation is 6 decibels per degree. Every time you change the sighting of your antenna, so that your radio horizon in that degree, in that direction, is 6 degrees lower than it was before, everything you listen to over that horizon is 6 dB louder. Now, HF is not quite that simple. In the case of HF, you don't have anywhere near the resources to put the antenna 10 and 20 and whatever number of wavelengths above the ground like you do on VHF and UHF, where pure altitude and pure geometry gives you most of the benefit, and clearing the foliage gives you most of the benefit. On HF, you now have to worry about the takeoff angle. Let me drop. In most of our HF situations, the antenna is usually less than one wavelength off the ground. And if it's a horizontally polarized antenna, you may think that there's dirt and grass and flowers and trees and whatever in your backyard. To that radio wave on, let's say, 80 or 40 meters, that Earth is nearly a perfect radio, a perfect mirror. Therefore, there's a real antenna above the ground, and there's another horizontal mirror image of the antenna below the ground. So far, that's not bad. But the problem is any signal that reflects off the ground experiences 180 degrees of phase reversal. Therefore, that mirror image of that antenna below the ground is out of phase. So if your real antenna is 30 feet above the ground, and the mirror image of that antenna is going to be another 30 feet below the ground, you really are running two dipoles that are 60 feet apart, 30 feet up and 30 feet down, and they're out of phase with each other. Therefore, you get a null on the horizon. At some particular angle above that horizon, you're adding more path length to the mirror image antenna versus the real antenna. And some particular angle above the ground, that extra path length makes them come back in phase again. That is your vertical radiation angle. It's a simple geometry problem. Make a side view picture of it with your real dipole shown end view above the ground and the mirror image of it below the ground, and recognize the fact that the one below the ground is out of phase, because that's the way ground reflection works, and you can very easily calculate at what angle above the ground am I going to get a peak of signal. You can look it up in books, or you can figure out that geometry. So your takeoff angle for a horizontal antenna is primarily defined by your altitude above the ground. Make the antenna a quarter wave or less above the ground, and you have a nevus antenna, near vertical incident sky wave. You're shooting the wave straight up, and almost none out to the horizon. And if that ionosphere is not dense enough today to reflect that signal back down, you're not going to get very far. So takeoff angle, I don't care how high the gain of your antenna is, that ground reflection, most of the time on HF antennas, dominates. Oh, if you're a guy, repeater, time out. If you're a guy like Dave Oline, K1WHS, up in Lebanon, Maine, where he's got something like 150 feet of a Rhone 55 tower, and he's got a bunch of antennas mounted along that whole vertical stack of that tower. Yes, his antennas are now controlling the vertical beamwidth. But without going to those kind of resources, your vertical takeoff angle is 90-some-odd% defined by what is the altitude above the ground, which really is the spacing between your image and real antenna. So horizontal has that characteristic. Altitude, the more the altitude, the lower that angle where everything comes back into phase, and the better your DX will be. Vertical is a lot friendlier than that, and therefore it's very sad that we haven't given enough emphasis to vertically polarized half-wave dipoles fed at the bottom or fed at the center if you insist. But you don't have to feed it at the center. There's nothing magic about that. The nice thing about a vertically polarized antenna is, for the most part, the ground reflection does not reverse in phase. So you give a little bit of altitude to a vertically polarized HF dipole in your backyard, and you're going to be squirting a lot more signal down to that horizon. These are my strongly felt opinions. Now, I'm a guy who's done very little HF real operating. I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF operator. So I'm a little bit of a fish out of water. I'm telling you what I know about the laws of physics, what I've gathered by what I've read and talked to people, but I don't have hands-on experience to give me 100% confirmation of everything I've said. But you take Mel, K2KEY, and his merry group of guys at the Kings County Radio Club, they've got a hell of a lot more of this hands-on experience of HF antennas, altitude, horizontal and vertical. I think he can contribute a lot more real information. Go right ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I've done a lot of, as you said, experimenting on HF with antennas at different altitudes, different configurations of antennas. And currently I have a tower in the backyard that's 85 feet tall that has stacked on a 2015 and 10-meter beam. And it's very satisfactory, works very satisfactory for DXing as far as I'm concerned. Particularly that my location also here is along the coast, 350 feet off the Atlantic Ocean, is also, I feel, a contributing factor. And the rule of thumb seems to be with anyone that you talk to, serious, so-called serious DXs, they always mention that they have their antennas, at least most of them, more than one wavelength above ground. They are serious about horizontal, seems to be the way the DXs go with beams of multi-elements, which some of these arrays could be quite big, such as the Big Bertha array, which I looked at a couple of places that have it, and they show stacked arrays with antennas starting at just about one wavelength above the ground and on whatever particular frequency that beam is, and going up. So that seems to be the one that the so-called, we call them the big guns, and whenever you hear a contest or whatever, and you hit them on, you know, you can tell who it is. You get used to hearing those call letters. And if you look into a few of them that have these setups, K3LR is the closest one here in Pennsylvania. If you just look up K3LR, you'll see some antenna arrangements there that he has that are just phenomenal. He's the company, his company is the one that goes and erects, I believe, the Big Bertha array, stick over.
Now, I'm a little bit worried that just because HF horizontally polarized antennas for DX operations is a popular antenna, and the DXers think it's the best way to go, that could be one of these self-fulfilling prophecies. Everyone is copying each other, and they're all going that way. The fact that not as many of the serious DXers are using vertical polarization, I think, is a little bit sad, although I can think of one immediate reason why a really serious DXer would be using less. To make a very large, let's say, rotating 80-meter or 40-meter 3, 4, or 5-element beam, and there are a few of those around the world, to make one of those horizontally polarized, if you've got the resources for the tower and the boom and the rotator, is a somewhat logical-looking construction. To try to make a 3-element Yagi on 80 meters vertically polarized means that a substantial portion of the antenna is co-polarized with the tower support structure. And that represents a problem. Not a problem in reality. It's a problem in thinking. Common sense would lead you to believe if my vertical, let me pick a number, 150-foot high tower that's supporting my vertically polarized three-element beam on, let's say, 80 or 40 meters, it would look in a photograph or in a diagram as if the tower is co-polarized with the elements of the antenna. It's shorting out the signal, and therefore it's not going to work. Good-sounding common sense. Dead wrong. Let me show you why. Let's just take the simple vertical dipole. Before you add any of the other parasitic elements, which increases its gain, and increased gain means more effective radio area. Let me drop. A pure vertically polarized 80-meter dipole must follow the laws of physics. The bedrock of the antenna science says gain equals, this is a formula, write it down if you like, gain equals 4 pi A over lambda squared. Gain equals 4 pi A over lambda squared. A is effective area, 4 pi is a constant, 12.6 roughly, and lambda is wavelength squared. You put that all together, it is a constant times area. Gain equals a constant. If you're not changing frequency, everything on that formula is a constant except area. Gain equals area. You solve it backwards, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug in the numbers and you realize that your 80-meter dipole has an area considerably more than 8,500 square feet. And I'm not kidding. You've heard me say that a lot of times. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you stand out there a fraction of a mile and you look at your 80-meter dipole, you'll see a great big black elliptical area of space around that dipole. And the area of that black space is 8,500 square meters. I think it actually calculates to 8,900. But I subtracted the numbers a little bit because of some losses of ground reflection or whatever. Almost 9,000 square feet of area. It's huge. Yes, the area you get from the tower that's supporting it is a small fraction of that. As massive as that tower looks, it's a small fraction. If you're building an 80-meter vertical dipole, I will admit that the nearby support structure, the tower, is adding some extra capacitance to that nearby parasitic element out in front, the director and the reflector out back. It's adding some nearby capacitance, which tunes it to a slightly lower frequency. But you're a smart enough guy, you know how to shorten the element to bring it back into resonance. That's no problem. So the slight amount of blockage you get from the vertical tower, and you wish that that vertical tower is made out of wood. It doesn't have to be. Don't do that. Leave it metal. It's got very little real area. It's got only a couple of percent of the area where it's casting a shadow on your great big antenna. And so the vertical support structure is not a real detriment. By the same token, let me drop. If you've got a horizontal 80-meter dipole, 50 feet in the air, and the Con Ed wiring, which is horizontal wire, is directly across the street from you, directly in the direction of London, and you want to talk to your buddy in London, you think that those wires are going to be a blockage. They're transparent. They're not there. As long as they're not resonant, they're not there. That wire casts a couple of square feet of shadow onto your 8,500 square foot area of your real dipole, which is resonant, and that's where all that area is coming from. If you did a careful experiment with all of that horizontally polarized wiring of Con Ed and LOCO and LIPA directly across the street from you at the exact same altitude, if you could do the experiment with that wiring being present and the wiring not being present, and you talk to your buddy in London, there may be a tenth of a dB of difference in signal strength, and I'm not kidding. Maybe two-tenths, worst case. Yes, there's a slim chance possibility that something really crazy is happening with that wiring where it happens to be resonant at 80 meters, in which case now you use it in your favor once you discover that, and you adjust things accordingly so that it becomes a Yagi, if you know what I mean. So in that case, yes, it would represent some substantial area if it resonates. You'd have to be very unlucky for that wiring to have just the right kind of mechanical layout and drops in the individual houses so that it becomes resonant at 80 meters or 40 meters. Very unlikely. Now, you can complain about the wiring having some arc over with an egg insulator on a rainy day and making some extra noise. And maybe you need a super good noise blanker to handle that. You can complain about the wiring doing that to you, but other than that, that wiring is not there. It's not transparent. The support tower for a purely vertically polarized, rotatable Yagi would not give you any substantial detriment if you know how to handle it. Strongly felt opinion, but it's controversial. You say this on 80 meters on a Saturday afternoon, and a whole lot of people will say, what in the world are you smoking, RIW, you're crazy. K2KEY, to add his words to all this, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, most definitely. You got to be very careful what you say on 75 meters at night, because you can get into a, as they say, a verbal fist fight very fast. I've had that experience. One of the antenna systems, however, that has become somewhat popular again, refers to K3LR. He seems to be doing some of the leading edge work and HF, you know, DXing antennas, low band DXing, one of the couple in the world that seems to be going into it in very, you know, very serious ways, with seems like a lot of funds to be able to devote it to it, because considering what he's invested in antennas, it's unbelievable. But he is also involved with the marketing of, say, phased verticals. Now, there's a number of stations that are on that have demonstrated their phased verticals, and have worked, they have seemed to be working out quite good as DX antennas. It takes a bit of, again, real estate to set up a phased vertical system, but they are manufacturing a switching system and the phase and the harnesses for phase vertical. So again, that's another way to go if you can't, you know, put up that so-called huge tower that is going to give you a couple of wavelengths on 80 meters. A number of the stations now are saying they're doing extremely well by using phase verticals, Dick, getting somewhat reasonable gain from systems like that. Over.
Run that by again now, Mel, back at 272. The guy with the big array in Maryland, I think it is a K2AR Kilo 2 Alpha Romeo. Go ahead.
Oh, K3LR, Kilo 3 LR, L like in London, R like in radio. Over.
Okay, I'm Googling those call letters right now, and okay, I do see a number of hits. Let me see also what his location is. Lima Radio is Lester Richter, Belvedere, New Jersey. That's the guy you're talking about, Mel?
Well, he's in Western Pennsylvania, I believe. K3LR, Kilo 3LR. I'm sure I have his call correctly. Maybe I ought to look it up. Maybe I'm getting one of those senior moments, but I believe it's K3LR, Dick, over.
Yeah, I made a big goof. I put in K2LR, K3LR, Timothy Duffy, West Middlesex, Pennsylvania. That's the guy?
Yeah, that's him. Spoke to him a number of times. I thought I had it right, Tim. And if you look at what he's got there, that Radio Shack, the equipment, I mean, it's a top-notch stuff, and the operating position and everything, it's just mind-boggling what he's invested, and his antenna systems are, the last word. Over.
Yeah, the first hit I got on Google is K3LR, multi-contest station, emergency communication races. He's got a zillion websites here. I'm looking for a picture of his antenna. I wonder if it's going to be as big as the one in Japan, where a guy has a fully rotatable five-element Yagi on 80 meters, built over the top of what looks like about a 10-story apartment building, and it's bigger than the building. I wonder if Mr. LR has got one of those. Mel, go ahead.
Well, the big beam on 80 meters that I know is, I think it's called WW1W. Yeah, Wally. I believe that's his, he's got a mountaintop somewhere in, he moved to New Hampshire or something. He put up, he's got a couple hundred foot of power on top of this hill that's about
82
KJ. Top of this tower is a three element 80 meter beam that had to be installed by helicopter, Dick. So he's another one. I've looked at his. It's another unbelievable setup over.
I just found a picture of K3LR's 80 meter beam, and I think it's a vertically polarized phased array, not quite the horizontal beam like I expect. Mr. KXK, I think I just heard. Go right ahead with your comment.
Ah, good evening, Dick. Keith here. KC2KXK. Yeah, I just had a curious question about a dipole. I got a D5RV myself, 102 foot, stretched up about 40 feet in the air in my backyard from tree to tree. But the property underneath it has a difference of elevation by about 10 feet. So actually one part of the dipole is 30 feet for about half of it. The other half is 40 feet up in the air. Does it make a difference if the dipole is not parallel with the ground plane?
Sure does. Absolutely, Keith, it makes a difference. And the difference has no significance. Because your ground is tilted with reference to the dipole, that means your mirror image is also tilted in the opposite manner. In other words, if it's the north end of your dipole that's closer to the ground, it's the north end of your mirror image that's closer to the surface, if you know what I mean. A mirror image all the way. And so therefore the emitted wave will have, let me think about that. I think it will still be horizontally polarized. Yes, because of the way the ground reflection combines with the direct signal, what you're transmitting, because let's assume now in worst case your ground is tilted by 10 degrees, and you think that what you're emitting is 10 degrees off of being pure horizontal. First of all, that doesn't matter because Faraday rotation dominates. That signal, when it goes through the ionosphere, twists two or three times between the time it goes from your house to London, let's say. So you can transmit a pure horizontal signal by whatever means, and he may get a pure vertical signal three twists later. An awful lot of the QSB fade that you hear on any of the HF bands you've ever worked on, half of the time it's due to Faraday rotation, in my opinion, which is not steady. It's continuously changing. The ionosphere is a plasma, a conducting media. It's got a magnetic field from the Earth mixed in it. Therefore, it rotates polarization. And it rotates polarization by a square law, one over the square law, and frequency, one over frequency squared. So as you go down lower in frequency, it rotates more and more. The guys on 80 meters, the guys on 2 meters doing moonbound, see a substantial amount of Faraday rotation that gives them problems. When you go from 2 meters all the way down to, let's say, 80 meters, boy, you're going to get a whole lot of it. So don't worry about the polarization of what you're transmitting. If this is the best of all worlds, Keith, you're going to have a horizontal antenna and a vertical antenna in the backyard. And when you listen on one of them and the guy goes into a QSB fade, you flip over to the other antenna, and half the time he will come back. So not to worry about that tilt, and polarization is nowhere near as critical as you think. KC2KXK, I think Mobile, K2RIW, you got a case. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. I tune into you, you know, every Sunday when I'm driving into work. It's very interesting and different topics you discuss, especially when you started getting into the space exploration with the Mars mission and whatnot that they're gearing up for. It's far, in the future, but it's definitely on the plate, hopefully. But thank you very much. Yeah, I think it, the way you were talking about the Faraday rotation, that probably had no effect whatsoever because, like you said, it's getting rotated all over the place anyway. But thanks anyway for the answer. It makes me feel a little better about the way I have it set up. Anyway, I'm just getting into work, so you guys have a good night. It's KC2KXK, I'll be clear at JFK. 73.
KC2KKX.
Debbie, Dennis, Debbie.
Okay, I heard KKX and something else that was so fast I couldn't catch it. Keith, every bit of altitude you can give to that dipole of yours will help. It will give you a lower angle of radiation. KKX, go right ahead and start off with your name, sir.
Name is Peter. My question is, if you have a copper roof on your house, how can you best take advantage of that in terms of a vertical antenna, perhaps, versus a horizontal dipole? And a quick aside, going to Mars seems very unlikely given the radiation exposure astronauts would receive. Unlikely they'll return healthy. But back to the copper roofs.
Yeah, the nice thing about your copper roof is that at some number of floors above ground, that gives you a big advantage. And assuming that all of the copper sheets are connected together so it acts like one great big sheet and it's elevated, I will admit that you've got one of the very few situations where it would be ideal to set up a pure vertical quarter wave ground plane or half wave vertical ground plane if you've got the resources to hold the radiator high enough. Half wave would be the best. Quarter wave will be very close to a similar performance. Half wave will be better because it's got a higher center of radiation. So you can take advantage of that copper. I'll admit that if you've set up a horizontal antenna, and you'd like the horizontal antenna to be, let me pick a number, a full wavelength above ground if you can get it, you'd like it to be, and for you to be a full wavelength above that copper represents a difficulty. The slight advantage you've got, though, remember this mirror image I'm talking about, that mirror image is on the assumption that you're standing out at a very long distance, mile away, not very far above the ground, looking back at the antenna. And you're looking at the real antenna above ground, you're looking at the mirror image below ground. When I stand a mile away, unless that roof of yours is 100 acres broad, I'm going to be at my angle of view. I'm not going to see the mirror image. Because from that far away, at that lower angle, because your copper roof only goes out there, let me pick a number, 100 feet, you don't get a chance to reflect off the copper roof before you get out to that signal that we're talking about. The roof ends. So the net result, as far as that signal is way far out is concerned, is that your horizontal dipole is now an extra 30 feet in the air, depending on what is the altitude of your copper roof. So if you're asking me, will a horizontal dipole in that environment work well? Yay, verily. Will a vertical dipole work well? Yay, verily. Which should I build, a horizontal or vertical dipole, or horizontal or vertical antenna? The answer is yes. Build whichever one or both. Go to it. And let us know how it works out, Peter. Mr. KKX, I don't know the prefix, K2RIW.
KC2KKX. And then placement on the roof, would it be better centered or off to the side? I suspect centered. And the copper roof is somewhat peaked.
Yeah, but what you're calling peaked is something your eye sees. How much peaking is there as far as wavelength at your frequency of concern? If I was building a parabolic dish, I would like the smoothness of the parabolic reflectors to be to the nearest eighth of a wavelength. And is your roof peaked up and down an eighth of a wavelength, and can you compensate for it? Of course the answer is yes. So I think the center is the best, although bear in mind what happens in the case of an automobile. If I mount a vertically polarized antenna on an automobile, the antenna tends to fire in the direction of maximum mass. In other words, if I put it at the rear left-hand end of the bumper, the antenna will fire with a stronger signal to the front right-hand side of the car. The antenna tends to fire in the direction of maximum mass. I think your copper roof will behave in a similar manner. So if you want to favor London, and assume that London is to the northeast of you, then mounting a vertical antenna on the southwestern corner of the copper would slightly favor London, as far as gain is concerned. But quite possibly you want to go to all directions at once, and therefore putting it in the center maybe is the right way. But if you've got the resources, there's nothing stopping you from putting more than one vertical, one in the center and one off to one side. Flip back and forth between them. Then feed them both simultaneously as a phased array. Adjust the phasing of the signal and the power ratio between the two, and boy, you're going to have a rock crusher in that direction, if you know what I mean, Keith. KC2, KKYX, K2LAW.
KC2, KKX, name's Peter. Anyway, thank you, Dick. Usually I just listen. Anyway, hope to get it up in the next few weeks, and hopefully I'll be able to report back.
Please do, Peter. Let us know how that works. There was another person who tried to sign in. Go a little bit slower and give it to us again. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
I wasn't sure if it was over or not. This is Anthony again, WFTW. I had wanted to ask you a space-related question because of, this weekend, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, space questions are fun. Tomorrow is the day that 40 years ago, Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon. Neil Armstrong was the chairman of the board of my company for about a 10-year period of time. I had a chance to see him face-to-face a few times. And also, man on Mars, it is my strong belief that essentially everyone within the sound of my voice will not see that happen in their lifetime or the lifetime of their children. And I'm basing that on the physics of nourishment and the reality of economics. The cost involved to send a man to Mars would require the contribution of almost every nation on this planet simultaneously. And what do you get in return as opposed to sending Spirit and Opportunity at a much lower price, at a much less risk to human life? So look, it's a great lofty idea. Until we come up with some kind of a real breakthrough in propulsion where we can get a man there in a month instead of a year and a half, I just don't think it's going to happen. Back to you. Let's see now. I guess it's Tony. You got it, Tony.
Yeah, Dick, very good. Thank you. WFTW here. Well, short comment on that. My mother asked you a question. You know, she was born in 1929, and she asked, when is going to be a rocket ship to Mars? And I told her, Mom, there's not going to be a rocket ship. We're going to have to build a road there. What do you mean by that? I said, well, we're going to have to make a habitat there robotically before we even get there. So at least if they get stuck there, they'll have some way to stay until whatever, a rescue mission, or if there's a ship that's another ship. Like I said, it'll be the cost of everything on Earth for a couple of years to do something like this. It's basically extending your Earth to Mars in a way. We'll have your waypoints where, basically almost space stations themselves, but interplanetary or another thing. I was reading the popular science or something, use one of the asteroids to figure out which one has the best orbit and use that as a waypoint. The thing will probably, whatever is going to have you launched, probably have to be launched from the moon, so we're going to have to set up something there beforehand. All our resources there is to build this thing to launch from there, which is 1/60 amount of gravity. I mean, the idea of launching something from the Earth to Mars is completely not feasible, so we can get that out of your mind. Just like the way, I never thought the Earth-Moon rendezvous thing, that wasn't thought of till quite a while. People thought there was going to be almost like cannon fire to the moon, almost Jules Verne-like. So you could get right rid of that concept also from back then. Let me drop it a second. Yeah, my question regarding space has to do at a much smaller level. I wanted to ask regarding components, mainly electrolytics, anything with fluids, how are these things considered, in the area of, controlled compression, decompression, when either a area that's manned or not manned, and also in the area of something that's suddenly decompressed or, well, likely decompressed or explosively decompresses in an accident. Electrolytics, anything with a vapor or metal, I guess they're sealed to a tremendous degree and, so nothing would affect them. And also, do they
probably try and get away from using anything fluid that has fluid or, you know, anything electrolytic in the first place. Back to you, Dick, WF2W.
WF2W, I thought it was WW2W. WF2W. Gotcha. Call letters wrong there, Tony. If I had to build all of the components of my electronics, my radios and whatever, and computers, in such a way that they can tolerate hard vacuum, relatively easy today to make hermetic sealed, so that no matter what's inside of a package of a capacitor, a resistor, a transistor, an integrated circuit or whatever, I can make it survive a hard vacuum. That's not too difficult. Sending a man to Mars is an exciting sounding idea. I'll bet you 90% of all the high school kids today are dreaming about that Mars trip, and they hope they're going to be the astronaut that goes. And it's an attractive sounding dream, and we should all have some dreams. But there's a problem here. We all forget about what this Earth is supplying to us, that every single molecule on this planet is recycled. Every breath of air you take contains molecules of oxygen and nitrogen and whatever that were once inside of the lung of every other human being that has ever walked this planet. Every single molecule eventually is recycled. That's item number one. Item number two, we forget what you consume. If I take the oxygen you're breathing right now, the water you're consuming, and the food you're consuming, and I pile it all in one spot, in 1 year, the amount of material that you consume occupies the volume of your house, and it has the mass of your house. 1 year of human sustaining life support materials has the volume of your house and the weight of your house, rough approximation. I might be wrong by 2 to 1. It doesn't matter. With current propulsion technology, it takes you more than a year to get to Mars. To come back, you have to stay on the planet another year and another year to come back. You need 3 years worth of materials, consumables, for each and every human being on board. 3 households worth per human being in mass and volume. And the first thing you're going to say is, okay, we'll recycle. Oh, really? You have to repeat it.
Time out.
To really recycle, you'd have to recycle every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid that comes out of that human being continuously for those 3 years. You can't possibly bring that amount of material with you. Oh, yes, if you've got the resources, you can send up 50 robot ships and have a whole bunch of supply ships along the way that you meet. I mean, right now, we send up a progress ship of thousands of pounds of materials every single couple of weeks to the International Space Station to maintain those astronauts. We forget about that. We forget about the consumables, the huge mass and volume of the consumables required to sustain a human being. The day will come and maybe we'll be able to recycle every molecule like I explained. But heaven help you if any of that machinery doing this recycling fails. It's game over. So the sheer dollars involved, the sheer difficulty of the travel, you've already talked about the radiation, the consumable requirement of food, oxygen, and water, these are all such huge problems. Just to say you've let a man walk on that soil of Mars. And yes, he's going to be a little bit better at deciding which rock to bring home and do a little bit better selecting and whatever, but compared to what you can do with a remote-controlled device like a Spirit or an Opportunity or the next version of the bigger one, the Mars laboratory that we're going to send up there, boy, that's a difficult comparison. It is difficult to justify, and I might be wrong, but I don't see it. I don't see it happen. I like space travel. I like what NASA does. But then, is this reasonable? What do you get in return to make a huge dollar investment and life investment to send a human being there as opposed to sending a vehicle? I think you see where I'm going on this one, Tony. Back to you. WF2W, K2RIW. You still there, Tony?
Yeah, I didn't realize you gave it back to me. Yeah, I know. It's the
you don't realize the amount that has to be recycled. I mean, we can, right now we can't even, we still have problems with putting people in a sealed thing here on Earth and, you know, try to act like as if they're in a terrarium, which is self-sustaining for certain reasons because they can't recycle, but you try to with human beings, like I said, the enclosed systems can't really handle that. And like I said, if something goes wrong, that's it. We're not really, if one of those moon missions had gone wrong on the moon, I think we would have been more prepared about mentally about things going that bad. I mean, the idea of them still being alive and just stranded on the moon, I don't think people realize what that psychologically entails, get?
Yeah, if that ascent engine on the lunar module, on any one of the, let's see now, Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, six landings on the moon. If any one of those ascent engines on that lunar module that's supposed to blast you off the lunar surface, put you, bring you back into a rendezvous with the command module and allow you to come back home, if any one of those ascent engines has misfired, it's game over. There is no backup for that. That particular engine has to go or it's game over. And thank goodness every sixth one of them worked like clockwork. And those were engines built into that Grumman module. And maybe that was a subcontractor. Maybe that engine was subcontracted to an engine manufacturer by Grumman. I don't know the details of that one. But if that engine was built by Grumman, and Grumman is not a rocket engine, a company that has a lot of history of building rocket engines, wow. And that particular engine had to have very volatile, dangerous, hypergolic materials. In other words, there is no local spark plug you can put into that engine that you can rely on. It had to have chemistry that explodes on contact. You just squirt the chemistry into that exhaust nozzle, it explodes on contact and the engine's working. But very high-speed, high-pressure pumps had to work just right for that engine to go. All those valves had to turn off just at the right time during the landing so you're ready to take off again. The guillotine devices that cut the wiring between the landing module and the return module had to work just right. Everything had to work just right. If one of those explosive bolts did not fire so that you separate the two craft, if the wiring didn't fire so you separate the craft, if that engine didn't go, there's just a zillion ways that it could have failed. The computer they had on board that did the navigating is a hell of a lot lower in capability than the $20 thing that you can put in your pocket today. It had a core memory system made out of a whole bunch of little bitty ferrite toroids for each individual bit of storage. And they came very close to a disaster when Neil Armstrong did the landing. Let me drop. The problem was that some very conservative person didn't tell everybody writing the manuals that he was going to order that the rendezvous radar be turned on and running during the landing. Just in case the landing got aborted, they wanted the radar up and running, and so that when they tried to rendezvous, if they aborted the landing, the radar would be ready to do that rendezvous. Without the radar, you might not be able to do it. But the radar running during the landing sequence was something the computer program was not planned on doing, and it was overloading the program, overloading the computer. The computer was giving them a 1601 failure, or whatever the hell the number was, over and over again. The computer was becoming saturated and rebooting itself. The computer that landed the Apollo 11 rebooted itself a number of times, started off from scratch during the landing sequence, and Armstrong took over manually. I don't have to tell you how close he came to a disaster. And by the way, on the practice module they had on the computer program, that on the simulator, the astronauts crashed the thing a couple of times in the computer program, not in reality. And by the way, Armstrong did have one practice run in which the thing went haywire and he had to use the escape module. Otherwise, he would have been heavily damaged, if not killed. There's a zillion ways this could have gone wrong. I think the early smart people on the program gave the whole program something like 75% probability of success on the first landing. Back to you. I guess it's Tony. I'm amazed that it all worked out as well as it did. Even though we had the Apollo 1 fire and we lost Grissom, White, and Chaffee, terrible incident. compared to all the other things that could have gone wrong. I think it was Apollo 10, I think it was, got in the vicinity of the moon, and a control system went haywire, and the whole spacecraft spun at an extremely high speed, almost to the point of knocking the astronauts unconscious. They just barely got control of that one on time. A lot of things could have gone wrong. Over to you, Tony, K2LAW.
KC2MDP.
MDP recognized, but Tony first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to conclude. Thank you, Dick, for your observations on that whole matter. It is a miracle. Even as a 9-year, almost a 10-year-old kid at the time, I was like, oh, this is all amazing for me. I used to love watching them showing all the models on TV and pivoting them before the age of computers. And I was at the Smithsonian, and I saw the core memory, and that's exactly very little when you say, it's very literal thing when you say core memory. I saw the little ferrites, you know, with the phase and sense and all that stuff. I think it ran on 2K memory. I wonder if by Apollo 17, I don't know, maybe they went way up to 8. So thanks for that information. Pick up the news station there, WFW.
Very fine, Tony. Good question. Glad you asked it. Steve, go right ahead, MDP.
Yeah, Dick. Wasn't Apollo 11 also the one they broke the switch off on the fire the ascent module, and they had to improvise and use a fountain pen or something to push it in? But I think there was also something with an ice blockage in the engine after they landed that could have caused a major problem. Back to you.
And when it comes to the ice blockage, you're absolutely right. On the ascent switch, that one I'm not sure. But on the ice blockage, yes. The fuel that was stuck in the pipe of the engine during the descent, where the engine now, the valve on both sides got closed, and this liquid fuel is now boiling off and creating high pressure. It could have easily exploded that particular piece of pipe, which could have done all kinds of local damage. And their ability to repair things on the moon, need I say, it would have been limited. Had that explosion made shrapnel that did something terrible. I mean, in order to save weight, the sides of the lunar module were made out of thin aluminum that is only a few times thicker than the aluminum foil that you wrap your food with. The astronauts, if they had done something crazy, could have easily kicked a hole in the side of the lunar module. It's my understanding. It was a very fragile thing to make it light enough so that the amount of available fuel could do everything that it had to do. They had to be very careful how they used all that hardware because it was delicate. Again, you can see a zillion ways that it could have gone wrong. And you might be right that they had to improvise with a fountain pen, with a ballpoint pen or whatever, to restore the switch. And maybe it's one of these switches that arms something, but it doesn't actually fire it at the instant of blastoff. And the instant of blastoff has to be very accurately timed, because you have to rendezvous with something that's up above you. The command module is in orbit around the moon, and he's moving a couple of thousand miles an hour. You've got to blast off at just the right time in order to meet up with him. And you don't want to spend a lot of time meeting up with him, because you're consuming what little bit of oxygen and fuel and everything else you got left. Oh, to maintain that human being requires a lot of stuff. Obvious by what happened on Apollo 13, where they lost an awful lot of just the oxygen to run everything because of the explosion of the tank. I came extremely close to being game over. That was right up to the end, a real close life and death situation as I see it, Steve. Back to you, Steve, K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I'll have to look into that thing with the fountain pen. I'm pretty sure it was Buzz Aldrin. From what I remember, they had an interview with him, and I think he kept the pen as a souvenir. I'll have to dig up that tape I have someplace and recheck that. Back to you.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I remember reading a switch problem in a pen. I thought it was on the command module for when they were going to come back, you know, they had the... And I know that was another problem. They worried about lighting that engine and coming back from around the moon, although they had done it previously on Apollo 8 and Apollo 10. I know that was a concern. But yeah, I think he might be right. I think it was on the ascent stage. And the aluminum skin on the LEM was 3 times the thickness of aluminum foil. That's the thickness.
And that has to sustain all of the air pressure on the inside when they're in a shirt sleeve environment, as they were during landing. I don't think they're wearing spacesuits during landing because they needed all the possible visibility. And to have that helmet on at the same time would have limited visibility. And all they had was this little triangular window to look out in order for Neil Armstrong to make a decision that, hey, this computer, which is being overloaded and rebooting, is bringing me down in the middle of a rock field. And he had to move a good fraction of a mile over to one side to find a clear place to actually land. And I think he had something. I know that I listened to a playback, and I remember the ground calling up to him 30 seconds, meaning you've got 30 seconds of fuel left. And I think he landed something like 15 or 20 seconds after that. If someone told me that he had only 15 seconds of fuel left before he would be crashing into the moon by pure gravity, I believe it. What do you think, Paul? I knew it was close. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it was about 15, 20 seconds left. But they argue about it. There might have been a little bit more, but then there might have been a little bit less. Because we talked about that one other week, maybe last week. They said the only way they're going to find out is to go up there and take a look. You know, one of the flights that land up there when I get another, after the moon is colonized, though. And maybe before they make it a museum up there and they have visitors, somebody will open up that tank and find out how much hydrazine, I think it was, that's left.
Well, no matter how good your shutoff valves are, Paul, everything leaks. The only thing you've discussed is leak rate. How much of the original fuel is going to be left in that tank after 40 years of closing of that particular valve? You don't just open up the tank and stick in a dipstick. I think that material is under pressure. I think it boils off automatically if it's not under pressure. I'm not sure about that one. But there's a rate at which that stuff is boiling off. So, and how do you determine how much is left in the tank? Well, maybe you disconnect the tank and weigh it or find out its mass by trying to put it in some kind of a spring mechanism and set it into oscillation. It would be a fun thing to know how much was left. I know he was getting near the end of his rope. And by the way, I think you already mentioned the fact that once he got below, I don't know what the number, maybe it's 1,000 feet, he did not have the ability to abort the landing. That the amount of time it takes to cut all the explosive bolts and whatever, to disconnect yourself from the landing module and then use the ascent module, I think he was in a scenario where he either landed or it's game over. Have I got that one slightly right, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I know they came in on their back and then tipped over, completely tipped over, looking forward. And then when they actually bring it straight back up, when they tipped over, ascent module went up, you know, they'd have a proper angle to get back up to meet the columns going around. But once he turned straight up to come down and land, it was some kind of a problem, I think, with the angle, that they won't have the proper angle. Although it seems like it would be, you know, straight up, it sounds like a good idea, but you had to be on an angle to really go into proper orbit. You know, they don't want to go straight up and then, you know, on an emergency ascent. Although when they launch, they go straight up, but then quickly the thrusters fire and they go on that angle to get the proper orbit. So I think that's right, Dick. There was a number of, I think it was 500 feet though. It rings a bell. It's all documented, but I think once they got below 500 feet, that it was over. I think it was like 2 or 3 minutes or something, tops, before landing, then they could abort.
So during that time, he saw the rock field, didn't land there. He was well below 500 feet looking at that rock field. He had no choice but to land. or to use what little bit of fuel is left to get above 500 feet in order to abort the landing. I don't think he had the ability to do that. It was a close shave. And a person could easily have nightmares over that one. Okay. Anybody with any further questions or comments, let me know now. If not, let the machine thoroughly drop to see if we have anybody outside of area that wants to add a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? Very noisy signal, and I didn't get the call. Want to try one more time?
Number Yankee 2, Sierra, India.
Something Yankee 2, Sierra, India. Want to try again? Very noisy signal.
Yankee 2, Sierra, India. There's a band opening, but I guess I'm not making it. No problem. 736.
Okay. Yankee 2, Sierra, India. Where are you located?
Staten Island, it's November, Yankee 2, Sierra, India. We've spoken before. Good evening.
Okay. Now I understand. Okay. Very noisy. If you talk slow enough, I think I'll understand what you're saying. Why don't you give it a try? November, Yankee 2, Sierra, India. Go right ahead.
Good evening. Normally I'm not able to check in, so there's some sort of a band opening. I was asked to talk to you the other day, a few months ago, Dick. I just was wondering what you thought about the skeptics that say the moon landing was a Hollywood stunt. I'm not saying I believe that. I just was wondering what your comments on that was. Back to net, NY2SI.
Okay, NY2SI. Wish I knew your name. It is sad that an awful lot of people think that it was a hoax. In order for it to be a hoax, you'd have to have thousands and thousands of people who work for NASA to all go along with the hoax. I mean, for us to keep a secret on something as vital as, let's say, nuclear design of a weapon, look how difficult that was. And you got a lot more people involved in the NASA program. And they all have to go along with the hoax. Very unlikely. I also personally built the equipment and aimed it at the moon and directly listened to Apollo 15 and 16. That signal was coming from the moon. And as they're on the way home, I could calculate exactly where they're supposed to be as the moon moved out from under where they were, and I saw them like 12 degrees behind the moon the first night and 24 degrees behind the moon the second night. They were in the exact correct position in space sending out the signal that I received. If somebody was creating a hoax and sending out hardware to send back that signal in the right direction, at the right position in space, at the right time, with the right Doppler shift, wow. It would take more effort to make that a hoax than to do it in reality. Because I personally listened to those signals with hardware that I constructed, me and my buddies constructed, and aimed in the right direction. There's no doubt in my mind. So for people to believe that, well, no matter what you say, there's always going to be somebody that's skeptical that it didn't really take place. And it's somewhat unavoidable, but it's crazy in the big picture. Mel, K2KEY, I bet you don't run the road with any Mel people very often. Go ahead, Mel, K2RIW.
Yes, oh yes. I've heard this story many times, that the whole thing was a hoax. And even though I've pointed out a number of factors that shows that it was, like you say, definitely they did land on the moon. These people are not easily convinced. Last week I had mentioned I had read somewhere that one of the trips to the moon, they had taken along a color camera, and that the camera was using at that time the only technology for a portable camera at the time was the use of a color wheel. Did you ever hear that, Dick, that was the technology of the time, over?
Yes, I have heard that, and I didn't read rapidly enough to get the whole article. Turns out that Eric mailed me a beautiful article describing the early camera, the camera breakthrough that was used on Apollo. I hope Eric is present. Maybe he can give us a couple of words on that. KE2EJ, if you're available, tell us anything about the lunar cameras, K2RIW. I'm a little bit afraid of that. I think Eric is not available. He mailed me an article on the subject. I'll mail you the website, Mel. and it explains an awful lot about the camera. And I think the early color cameras, I believe they did have to be a color wheel, because the three Vidicon approach or whatever to get a color picture is quite difficult. Now, Bert Soltoff, K3IUV, is a guy who I know pretty well. He and I used to talk on 432 week after week after week for years on end. He ran the get-together on Monday night of the Pack Rats in the Philadelphia area of Pennsylvania. Bert Soltoff, K3IUV, worked for RCA Astro, who built the color camera that was used on Apollo 14 and later. Beautiful camera that could be aimed directly at the sun without damage. Whereas the color camera that was used on Apollo 12, I think it was, the sun swept through the field very rapidly early in the mission, wiped out the camera, and they never got any more surface pictures. So I think it was Kurt Soltoff's camera crew at RCA Astro, I think is where he was working at the time, became the camera on either Apollo 14 or Apollo 15. And the rest of the missions used that camera on the lunar rover car, and I think they may have used one more of them in at least one other location. Therefore, you did get some beautiful color pictures from a camera of later design, and the later camera, I think, did not have a color wheel. So I think Apollo 12 may have been the one with the color wheel, is my guess right now, until I look into it a little bit further. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I was just curious. I had read somewhere about the use of a color wheel in a camera, and I would have think that that was the only way that they could build a compact unit at the time.